Hi, my name's Gareth Briley.
And I'm Bernadette Russell.
And we are White Rabbit. And we are about to do a podcast and a series of podcasts under the theme of wonder. Now, we haven't done one of these for a while, have we? But what we normally do is we normally do storytelling nights and we do podcasts as well that showcase writers' new work.
So we do a live storytelling night of Robbie's Walkers, good fun, loads of nice homemade cakes, sandwiches, wild games, sparklers.
But we're in a really strange place at the moment, because the time of this recording, we're in the pandemic of the COVID-19. And so we had to cancel the live event for Wonder.
Well, postpone it.
Postpone it to the autumn or when we get over this. And but we were going to do this. We're always planning to do this podcast with some of the writers that are not in the live night, that they're more suitable for podcasts and that we're completely proud of. So we're going to do a series of these, the first of every month from April. And you should be listening to the first one now, April, hopefully. this is what you're going to do. So all you're going to do is do a couple of stories per month. And we've got two brilliant stories for us today, haven't we?
I guess we should say that as well, this the project was all based around a wonderful venue in Ashford in Kent called Revelation, which is a beautiful 11th century church and theatre and arts venue. And all the writers are local writers who've responded to the theme of wonder, which we decided was a really nice sort of positive, uplifting theme to think about all the wonderful things in the world. So yeah, we're really pleased with what's coming and we hope you make yourself a cup of tea or something stronger.
Something stronger, please.
And settle down and we hope you're sitting comfortably and we'll begin.
This first story is by Ian M. MacDonald, and it's called The Old Shooting Gallery. The restaurant is small and cosy, and a lot of the diners have no idea about the significance of its name or the history of its owner and head chef, Vladimir. The restaurant is admired and praised by high-class critics who have little to do with the rest of us. But Vladimir does not care for the colonists. He cares for us and the people like us before, who weren't granted the same freedoms and privileges. At least that is what he proclaims at the opening of each service of the restaurant. It's a small team, and many employees are there for years. Staff turnover is small. The pace of the restaurant is pleasant in spite of the intense attention to flavour, detail and authenticity which is encouraged, and mistakes or lack of commitment are not treated favourably. Dedication and rigour, however, are celebrated at the end of every shift, and the team is a close-knit thing. Wine and meals are shared together after every shift, and even Vladimir himself helps with the cleaning up and polishing of the cutlery, and sometimes the restocking of the restrooms, even if it has been an honestly busy and strenuous service. The five new chefs who have been considered for employment after Thomas left for the silver service of the city, which always tempts the best of them, are standing in a line out of the back of the restaurant. There is a large garden space here with ample, fertile beds for growing herbs and vegetables, and there is a greenhouse for the tomatoes and less hardy crops. And between the garden and the restaurant, there is an 8-foot wall of concrete, which is unconnected to the restaurant itself. A seemingly random placement of partition. Between the wall and the restaurant is where the bins and garden equipment are kept. And it's in this hideaway the staff smoke their cigarettes. On the garden side of the wall, where the shortlisted chefs stand between the beds of crops and the greenhouse, there is a 6-foot square patch of cracked and brown compacted dirt. All the potential staff of the place go through the routine before they're hired, from the pot wash through to the maitre d'. Vladimir looks at the wall, and as he's looking at an army sergeant he fears and admires, or if he's paying special attention to a significant work of art. The wall looks as if it has been whitewashed many times over, and it's littered with small, deep chips. And some of the scars have been refilled partly with paint at different occasions, so they vary between different shades of off-white and dirty brown cream. There are 20 to 30 marks in the wall, which are clearly bullet holes from the other afflictions. On first glance, could have been made by any implement such as a chisel or hammer. Although, when one knows the history of the place, it is obvious that these other marks have also been made by bullets which have ricocheted off bones and brittle concrete. What do you think of when I tell you of all the men who have died here and are buried all on top of each other beneath us? Vladimir says in the manner of a solemn and enunciated actor of high regard. Most of the men mumble that it makes them sad or melancholy. A couple glance around the garden at the earth where the ingredients grow, and they try, or try not to, picture the piles of dead bodies in shallow graves, which, perhaps along with the generous sunshine, is the reason the crops grow so eagerly. What would it make you to feel to serve food in such a place? Vladimir asks then. There is silence. This is the question most applicants struggle with. Four of the five shuffle uncomfortably and glance between Vladimir and the wall. Cutlery clatters in the kitchen. There is one answer that Vladimir wants to hear, and there is always one and only one who dares to offer it. Perhaps there is only one who even thinks it each time. And this is always a man who gets the job, no matter their schooling, no matter whose masterly protege Vladimir is in receipt of. Vladimir waits patiently. One of the men looks as if he's going to speak, but Vladimir already knows it is not this one who will say it, and not this one who will get the job. Perhaps in a leading way, he looks to the man he already knows will offer the correct position. Perhaps Vladimir is encouraging the chef, but it is debatable whether the young, frazzled man reads the signal. His eyes glaze over and he looks at the wall. He's a skinny fellow with bad skin and tattoos on his knuckles and up his arm. His hair is greasy and he spots a three-day-old beard of downy hair which, despite his craggy skin, betrays his youth. This young chef opens his mouth to speak.
"I will feel proud," he says, as a couple of the other chefs glance cautiously at him and shuffle their feet. I would feel proud to serve beauty where before there has been so much awfulness, sorrow, pain. It would do these men an honour, chef."
The others understand now, and they almost certainly understand that this chef's inarticulate but honest elocution means they have not got the job, and that the young, pockmarked man has. Vladimir nods, holds out his right hand in another theatrical motion to direct the man back into the kitchen, a welcoming and conciliatory gesture.
"Gentlemen, let's see about that rule," he says.
Thank you very much. And The Old Shooting Gallery by Ian M. MacDonald.
That was fantastic. Thank you. This next story is called Froth Atop a Latte, and it's by Deborah Gasking. "High weaving heather, thrown this way and that on each whim of the high weaving winds. Bright sunshine clowns tumble my stomach,
tighten, slacken, contort. Pace and chills prickle my skin, skimming jaggedly in my flowing blood tubules. Warm breezes freshen my brow lines, lift the left and the right of my lips up into moon dimples. How I melt into nature's forces as I sit. Of course I'm early, usually I'm late, but this day and time I'm so very early. Yet I'm 25 years late. Carmen, she's always been Carmen in my head. I'm no romantic, but he was my fiery gypsy, and me an Irish Roman Catholic, a role swap for my personal version of the opera. 8 months following this world-weary, enduring cliché of seduction and abandonment, my life was redirected, just shy of 16. 1981 trapped and shamed me, the harlot of our church, a stigma on my family. And as surely as night follows day, it was get thee to a nunnery, or rather the nun's laundry. A decade searching, requesting, filing, a decade of secrets piled atop those stacked the preceding 15 years. Murky waters does not do it justice. 10 years of lies and hidden truths I tucked under the ironing pile, a pile in perpetual motion, both never completely dealt with. An husband of 7 years, he who doesn't do domestic. Yeah, I've got one of those, but hey, my advantage. And never one for questioning. He bought my scar story, the one under which my uterus was removed. You see, those Magdalene nun bitches had the ear of the obstetrician. Snip out tubes. And the Catholic bastard obliged. Make them very, very short. And the misogynist made sure I'd never, ever need his services again. Let that learn her. Years after this caesarean section, sterilisation, in my cosy normal marriage, tiny feet did not patter. Medical notes assessed. Ah, that'll be why. Shh, mustn't tell. Time is tick-tocking, hooking my thoughts, memories. And I sit, not sipping a cooling latte, stuck in my past. Here in the starlight fair trade cafe, Carmen's, Charmaine's suggestion. Contrasting, yet similar names. And not to my choice. Emotions jostle their sparring match. She's mine, but she's not. Stolen, but given away. Choices, but no choices. Bubble my emotions. My emotions bubbled as I grew. The you're our chosen child, the you're our rescued child, the God's gift to us, trickled into my empty head and gathered, herded, corralled, puddled over the years and swamped. Not entirely sure of the trigger. Not prepubertal hormones, a bit late for that. I guess it was a documentary, a repeat from way back. Can't remember what it was called, but definitely remember as if it's on a loop on my glasses lenses about forced adoption, about those kids, orphans I were told, sent to Australia for their own good. Going to nice homes, fooled, skivvies a lot of them, you couldn't make it up, and being kids, you know, they didn't have a voice. And it was this documentary that flooded that puddle until it pulsed up from my guts and almost burst from me. A bit like that old film in which the alien bursts out of its mother's belly. Yeah, it was called Alien. And I think it was a documentary that finally kicked it off. With this Gemma in Australia, who at the same time was the same age as me, bar just a few months. And you know how weird that is when you can relate so precisely with someone? Well, it was when Gemma saw her birth certificate for the first time. And it was one of those wow moments for both her and me. And I now feel akin with her because she tipped my flood into a surge of questions and exclamations of pulsing shockwaves, all while I was sitting there neatly with Mum and Dad, my second family. Sitting there with this huge mega flood, and I had to statue myself to keep it under, because if I'd let just a little drip, then it would rip me and think my parents would have thought Beelzebub had thrust into their lives. And well, you know, they're nice people, they're godly people. And they'd done good adopting me, and I'd behaved good for them because they'd adopted me. Their chosen child. And then the secrets just stacked. You know, all the paperwork I kept hidden, and I had to pretend to the agencies that we had no phone because we were godly people. Weird, but they bought it. And I got Belle to let me use her address for everything, and the agency agreed to that as well. Actually, as I'm thinking about it, they probably saw through all that crap but understood the whys. probably wouldn't be surprised. Seen it all before. And there she was. My mum. Well, on paper at least. She'd made inquiries. My mum was looking for me. And you know, when you're feeling you're being smart and got control, we always get this massive kick. And that's what I got when I saw my mum's name and address. And really and truly, there was another mega flood of feelings and emotions I'd never known. And there she is. My mum. Sitting in the window seat. Seems to be in a dolly daydream. Latte, froth atop her mug. And remember those floods of mine? Kept in. Tucked down till now, these tears salty and relieving and painful pop out of me as I stare at her as she stares at me. And she must have the same floods because her face is wet and salty with relief and pain. Oh, there she is. I know it's her. She's the image of me 15 years ago when I had fewer and shallower crinkles littering the skin on my face. My glorious daughter. Relief. Wonder. Hope. Guilt. And that was Froth Atop a Latte by Deborah Gaskin. Thank you so much to both of our writers for those lovely stories.
Thank you, Ian. Ian MacDonald.
And thank you, Deborah Gaskin.
Yeah, and that's good. That's our first one done.
Lovely.
That went quick, didn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe to us.
Yeah.
Whatever format you're using. Leave a comment. Leave anything you want. Nothing negative. Don't go there. We're all having a bad time as it is. But if you like it as positive, please leave something. Leave a comment. Do the star system if you're on Apple. That'd be really appreciated.
So we're going to be rolling out these podcasts once a month. We're really excited about what we've got coming up. Hope you're enjoying them. Hope everybody's taking care of themselves and managing to stay healthy and happy and entertained and not stockpiling toilet rolls. And let's have an abundance of being nice to each other and looking after our neighbours and noticing the daffodils.
Yeah, notice
because spring
daffodils.
Spring is springing
in the air.
And the world is full of wonders.
Yes.
See you next time.
See you next time. Bye.